Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population. After those 22 days, Israel tried hard to deflect some of the criticisms directed at it. For example, Israeli attacks damaged or destroyed 29 ambulances. Israeli attacks damaged or destroyed almost half of Gaza's 122 health facilities, including 15 hospitals. Israel said, well, what can we do? These Hamas militants, these cowards and lunatics, they were using the hospitals as refuge. But then the human rights organizations investigated the allegation after the end of the invasion. One human rights organization, two, three, four, five, six, really. They all investigated it separately. They all came to the same conclusion. There is no evidence that Hamas militants were hiding in the hospitals. Then Israel said Hamas was using the ambulances to ferry around ammunition, weapons, and terrorists. Human rights organizations investigated the charge. They found no evidence. In fact, Israel's own ambulatory service, it's called Magen David Adom, they themselves publicly testified, and now I'm quoting them. There was no use of Palestinian Red Crescent Society ambulances for the transport of weapons or ammunition. Even Israel's own ambulatory service said it's just not true. Nonetheless, Israel damaged or destroyed 29 ambulances. Then Israel destroyed 30 mosques and damaged 15 more. Israel said the mosques were being used to conceal weapons and were being used to launch attacks. The mission headed by Richard Goldstone, to whom I'll return, he investigated one case of what he called an intentional Israeli attack on a mosque that killed at least 15 Palestinians who were attending service. What did he conclude? He concluded, quote, there's no evidence that this mosque was used for the storage of weapons or any military activity by Palestinian armed groups. But Israel says, okay, maybe not that mosque, but other mosques were being used to store weapons and so forth. There's still a problem, because Israel targeted all the minarets on the mosques in Gaza. The minarets are too narrow, the Gaza minarets are too narrow, they don't contain staircases. And so they could not have been used by snipers or lookouts. So why did Israel target the minarets? There's a very good, very excellent South African jurist named John Dugard. And Mr. Dugard led a mission to Gaza, a fact-finding mission. He investigated this matter, and this is what he concluded. The mosques, and more particularly the minarets, had been targeted on the grounds that they symbolized Islam. They were targeted because they symbolized Islam. Well, that's a good reason. You can't quarrel with that. But we all know that it's not so simple, because you know those Hamas lunatics and cowards, they were using the Palestinians in Gaza as human shields. They were forcing the Palestinians in front of them in order to force Israel to fire on civilians. Israel had no choice because Hamas was using the Palestinian civilians as human shields. Again, all the human rights organizations investigated the claim, the allegation. The most respected of all the human rights organizations is, of course, Amnesty International, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. Amnesty did a very exhaustive study of this human shield issue. Here's what they concluded. Contrary to repeated allegations by Israeli officials of the use of human shields, Amnesty International found no evidence that Hamas or other Palestinian fighters directed the movement of civilians to shield military objectives from attacks. Amnesty International found no evidence that Hamas or other armed groups forced residents to stay in or around buildings used by fighters. Amnesty International found no evidence that fighters prevented residents from leaving buildings or areas which had been commandeered by militants. It just didn't happen. Even if it were true that Hamas had engaged in human shielding, even if it were true, it still could not explain the deaths in Gaza. Why? Well, here's what Amnesty had to say. The attacks that caused the greatest number of fatalities and injuries, the Palestinians, they were not caught in the crossfire of battles between Palestinian militants and Israeli forces. How did they die? Many were killed when their homes were bombed while they slept. Others were going about their daily activities in their homes, sitting in their yard, hanging the laundry on the roof, when they were targeted in airstrikes or tank shelling. How did the children die? Those 358 Palestinian children. Was Hamas using them as human shields? Here's what Amnesty said. The children were studying or playing in their bedrooms or on the roof or outside their homes when they were struck by missiles or tank shells. It's not true, however, it's emphatically not true, that there was no human shielding in Gaza. In fact, there was quite a lot. By Israel, Israel was using Palestinians as human shields, and that fact has been voluminously documented by human rights organizations. All the investigative bodies concluded that Israel committed multiple war crimes. As many of you know, after the Gaza invasion, the Gaza massacre, there were many human rights investigations of what happened. The best known, probably known to everybody in this room, was one that was commissioned by the United Nations Human Rights Council. And they appointed a fellow named Richard Goldstone, a South African jurist, an eminent international prosecutor. He headed up the prosecutions in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. They named Richard Goldstone as the head of the mission. And a few months later, he produced a quite substantial report. It ran to about 500 pages, single-spaced. Its main conclusions, or the ones that should concern us here, are first, he said, that Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population. That's his words in quotes. Israel launched a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. But maybe what happened in Gaza was because some soldiers just went berserk. It was some rotten apples in the barrel. But the Goldstone Mission said, no, that's not really possible. The mission concluded, the systematic and deliberate nature of the activities leave the mission in no doubt that responsibility lies in the first place with those who designed, planned, ordered, and oversaw the operations. It was not a few rotten apples, a few soldiers who went awry. According to the Goldstone Mission, it was Israel's political and military leaders who planned and oversaw the disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population. Some people criticized the Goldstone report. They said, well, these sorts of allegations, they're kind of extreme. How can he reach conclusions which are so radical? Problem was that Goldstone couldn't but reach that conclusion because this is what the Israeli leaders were saying before, during, and after the attack. It's not as if the Israelis lacked in candor. They were very honest about what they intended to do and what they did do. Before the attack, the Israeli head of the Northern Command, he said, in the next war, we will yield disproportionate power against every village from which shots are fired on Israel. We will cause immense damage and destruction. The former head of Israel's National Security Council, he said, in the next war, it will lead to intense suffering among the enemy population, the destruction of homes and infrastructure. It will lead to the suffering of hundreds of thousands of people. During the attack, Israel's foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, she said, Hamas now understands that when you fire on Israel's citizens, it responds by going wild. And that is a good thing. The day after the attack, Ms. Livni said on Channel 10 News in Israel, quote, Israel demonstrated real hooliganism during the course of the recent operation, which is what I demanded. And then a strange thing happened with Ms. Livni. She went to the United Kingdom, she got off her plane, and somebody presented her with papers that she's a war criminal. And she was shocked. She was completely shocked. Ms. Livni was bewildered. She was perplexed because she was certain that real hooliganism, it was protected by the Geneva Conventions. After the attack, a former Israeli defense official, he said, with an armada of fighter planes attacking Gaza, Israel decided to play the role of a mad dog for the sake of future deterrence. A former senior Israeli security official, he boasted that Israel had restored its deterrence capacity. The Arabs now fear Israel. Why? He said, because Israel has shown Hamas, Iran, and the region that it can be as lunatic as any of them. Lunatic? Mad dog, real hooliganism, wild, immense suffering. What else could the Goldstone Mission conclude except that Israel intend to punish, humiliate, and terrorize the civilian population, and that the decisions were made by the senior leaders in the military and in the political life of Israel? When the Goldstone mission report came out, as most of you know, it evoked a hysterical reaction among Israelis across the political spectrum, not just the so-called right wing, but the doves, the ones we're told are lovers of peace. So, for example, Sir Shimon Peres, because the British knighted him, Sir Peres, the Nobel laureate for peace, he said that the Goldstone Report is a mockery of history, and that Goldstone is a small man devoid of any sense of justice. The Israeli ambassador to the United States, a fellow named Michael Oren, some people think he's a historian, Mr. Oren said that the Goldstone Report was even worse than Ahmadinejad and the Holocaust deniers. Back in the United States, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, he said the Goldstone Report is so filled with lies, distortions, and blood libels that it could have been drafted by Hamas extremists. He said it recalled the protocols of the Elders of Zion. He said that Goldstone was an evil man, an absolute traitor. You could just imagine how indignant he would have been if he actually read the report. Now, as some of you know, every circus needs a clown. So along came Elie Wiesel. He called the report a crime against the Jewish people. And now the interesting question comes up. Why the hysterical reaction against the Goldstone Report? Because the Goldstone Report, as I said, was the last in a long line of reports that were issued after the Gaza massacre. Amnesty International issued 2 reports. Human Rights Watch issued 6 reports. There were reports issued by Palestinian human rights organizations, Israeli human rights organizations. There were independent international fact-finding missions. Why the hysteria over the Goldstone Report? In fact, the Goldstone Report, although excellent in my opinion, was probably the most conservative, cautious, and judicious of all the reports. So why were the Israelis and their American supporters so hysterical? And the answer is not hard to find. Because Mr. Goldstone is not only Jewish, but he's a self-declared Zionist. He says, I worked for Israel all of my adult life. I fully support Israel's right to exist. I am a firm believer in the absolute right of the Jewish people to have their home there. That's Mr. Goldstone. Mr. Goldstone sits in the board of governors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He received an honorary doctorate from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. His daughter went to live in Israel. When Goldstone was asked, why did you go into human rights law, international law? He said it was because of the Nazi Holocaust. And so now Israel had a real problem on its hands. Because for decades, it's perfected these ideological weapons to discredit any critics of Israel and to discredit any criticism of Israel. So if you criticize Israel, you must be an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew or a Holocaust denier. But Mr. Goldstone's person and his profession now made it impossible to use those weapons any longer. He neutralized those weapons. As the Israeli columnist Gideon Levy put it, this time with Goldstone, the messenger is propaganda proof. Mr. Goldstone, he doesn't seem like your typical anti-Semite. He doesn't act like your typical self-hating Jew. He says, I love Israel, I'm a Zionist. He doesn't seem like your typical Holocaust denier. He says it's because of the Holocaust they went into human rights law. Well, if Mr. Goldstone is not an anti-Semite, if he's not a self-hating Jew, if he's not a Holocaust denier, if he's not incompetent or a fool, and the former chief prosecutor in the tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda doesn't seem like an incompetent or a fool. So the only plausible explanation for the devastating content of the report he authored, the only possible explanation was it was true. And for Israel, this sent them into panic mode. There was just no way to neutralize him. All of their weapons were now proven ineffective. There are many consequences of the Goldstone report. I'm just going to look at one. Namely, Goldstone is in many ways a classic liberal Jew, a defender of human rights, a defender of the rule of law. Most Jews are liberal. That's just a fact. In the United States, 80% of American Jews voted for Obama. Among Latinos, it was about 67%. Among whites in general, it was about 43%. The only ethnic group that voted in larger numbers for Obama was obviously African Americans. If you factor in income, Jews should be voting overwhelmingly Republican because they're by far and away the wealthiest economic group in the United States, but they don't vote Republican. Jews vote Democrat because Jews are overwhelmingly liberal. What does it mean to be liberal? It means support for the rule of law, support for international institutions, support for human rights. Everybody in this room knows Amnesty International, it's a liberal organization. Human Rights Watch, it's a liberal organization. And now Goldstone, he embodied the conflict now among many Jews. That is, it's no longer possible to call yourself liberal and defend Israeli policies and conduct. And so the Goldstone report, in many respects, marks a turning point, the beginning of the breakup of American Jewish support for Israel, because Jews are liberal, and it was liberal organizations and liberal individuals, like Mr. Goldstone, who were leading the indictment of what Israel did in Gaza. And the last point, what should we do? There was a fellow named Mr. Gandhi, most of you know him, Mahatma from India. He had a movement of nonviolent resistance. Originally they called it passive resistance. And Gandhi didn't like that term at all because he said nonviolent resistance is the most active resistance there is, the most courageous resistance there is. And he looked around for another term to describe his movement. And the term, I guess it was his cousin came up with, was satyagraha. He said the insistence upon truth, but it's usually translated a little bit more colloquially as hold on to the truth. Hold on to the truth. I've always liked that image. You cling almost as if in desperation. You cling to the truth. Hold on to the truth. And I think that's our challenge. We have to hold on to the truth that what Israel has done to the Palestinians is wrong. And it's indefensible. We have to hold on to the truth that a diplomatic settlement of the conflict is within reach. But it's Israel, backed by the United States, that are blocking that settlement. If we learn how to wield the weapon of truth, as it's recorded in the findings of the human rights community. And if we learn how to wield the weapon of justice, justice as it's embodied in the uncontroversial principles of international law. And I would want to stress the uncontroversial principles of international law. When the question of the wall that Israel is building went to the International Court of Justice in July 2004, all 15 judges, not one, not two, not three, not just a plurality, not a majority, all 15 judges ruled that the settlements Israel has been building in the occupied territories are illegal under international law. That's an uncontroversial principle of international law. We should bear in mind what we're all about. We shouldn't forget, as the African-American spiritual puts it, we want to keep our eyes on the prize. Keep our eyes on the prize. And the prize is we want to settle the conflict. We want to enable everyone to lead peaceful, productive, and proud lives. That's our goal. We want to enable everybody to have human dignity. And our plea, in my opinion, should be, let's be reasonable. Let's be reasonable. Let's hold on to the truth. Let's hold on to the basic principles of justice. The late Professor Edward Said, towards the end of his life, he liked to quote the Caribbean poet M.A. Césaire, "There's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory." There's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. We don't want to exclude anyone who's reasonable. We don't want to exclude anyone who's willing to accept the truth. We don't want to exclude anyone who's willing to uphold the basic principles of truth and justice. And if you embrace that simple formula, you support truth, you support justice, then there's room for you, there's room for everyone at the rendezvous of victory. I've been at this now for about 30 years. I first got involved in June 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon. And I'm determined that I'm going to be there one way or another at that rendezvous of victory. And I hope I'll be there with you all as well. Thank you.